Hi, everyone. My name is Georgia. I'm an alcoholic. It's really good to be here, good to be sober. Thank you to the committee, Deborah and Carol, for asking me, and Megan for being my host. Love you, doll. That's so funny. I've seen a lot of old friends and new friends, and thank you, Miss Annie, for the coffee this morning. Yeah, she's the reason I'm able to stand up here. Anyway, I'm so grateful today to have a solution for what's wrong with me. And for a long time, I didn't know what was wrong with me. And now I know it's that I'm an alcoholic and I suffer from alcoholism. And because I know that, there's a solution for all of my problems today. And it turns out the solution is the same for all of my problems. Although for the last 21 years of my sobriety, I'm always thinking maybe this time is different. But because I know what's wrong with me, I know the solution is that I use all the tools I've been given here in AA. And if I do that every day, if I work on my spiritual condition every day, go to meetings, call my sponsor, work with the sponsor, do the steps, help other people, read the book, pray, you know, all of those tools. If I just focus on that every day, it seems that my work problems seem to resolve. My relationship problems seem to resolve. Health problems, not so much, but I'm in a better spiritual condition to deal with that. So this is my solution, work on my spiritual condition every day. And what a great treatment for a fatal disease. So much better than chemo or so many of the other, you know, diseases that we suffer from. You know, that our solution is we come together and we share our stories. And by telling you things I swore I'd never tell another soul, because it made me feel like if you didn't really know those things, then you would love me. But by telling you those things, I'm set free, but you are too. And it's when we share those things that we swore we'd never share with someone else that that separateness suddenly disappears. And what a gift that is. I'm just so grateful to have this fatal disease that has led me to you today. You know, I'm, as I mentioned, I'm sober 21 years. My sobriety date is February 1st, 1993. And I got sober when I was 24, which makes me really old, and at 46. And I realize that there are people who are older than that here, but this is the oldest I've ever been. And I find myself, you know, like walking past a store window or something, and I'll see something out of the corner of my eye, and I'll be like, Mom, and it's me. So anyway, I grew up with a group of friends, and our slogan or our what we aspired to do was die young, stay pretty. It was a song by Blondie, and that's what we wanted to do. And now I have to have another set of dreams because I'm getting a little long in the tooth for the whole die young, stay pretty thing. We loved the, you know, all the people in the 27 Club, like Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison. They all died at 27, you know, and it just seemed like really cool when I was 13. When you start getting around that age, you're like, ooh, not so cool. I don't remember a time when alcohol wasn't in my life. I have had alcohol in my life since I was a wee lass. I have pictures when I was a baby drinking out of my dad's beer. I don't think I was, you know, getting wasted or anything, but there was never, like, I don't have my first drink experience because I was always kind of drinking out of the adult's drinks until later. My dad died when I was 6. He died of cancer, and I was left with my mom. And my mom, when my dad died, didn't work. She didn't drive, so it was a big change in our household, and my mom had to work 3 jobs to support us. She had to learn to drive. She was 47 when she learned how to drive, which was really, she was always terrified, and she was always kind of angry and depressed. That's how I remember my mom, and she never dated again. She never really had any friends, but then again, she was working 2 jobs every weekday, and then she worked on the weekends. And when she was at home, she sat in front of the TV with her remote control and her actually, I don't even know if we had a remote control back then. She had to get up from her chair. It even made it worse. she smoked her more menthols and talked about the dirty, rotten bastards in the world and, you know, just was really angry. And then sometimes she was really, really funny and sometimes was interested in what I was doing, but I never knew. And so I would walk in the door and I would say hello and I would get, "Not now, Georgie!" Just like she was just at her wit's end at hello. So at a young age, I learned to find my love in other places. And I wouldn't have said it when I first got sober because I was such a victim until I got to that fourth column of the fourth step where we look at our faults. But I was kind of a hoe. Because I was so, I wasn't able to articulate it at the time, but I was so desperate for love, and I had this underlying feeling that if somebody loved me, then I would be okay. And so at a very young age, I started looking for that love. I heard somebody say this at my Wednesday night meeting, and it's always stuck with me, and that was my first higher power was your approval. And I so get that. You know, I was constantly looking at you to tell me I was okay, to show me in your eyes. I would know. If you looked at me funny, I would know that you didn't approve of me, and it would break my heart, and I couldn't talk to you anymore. And so I was constantly looking for that. And so I started finding that with neighborhood kids that were older than me. I started stealing my mom's car. I started smoking her cigarettes at 10 years old at a 16-year-old boyfriend, which is just way too creepy to even imagine today. But I always looked older than I was. I always felt older than I was. I always thought somehow if I could be an adult, I could somehow grasp these huge emotions I seemed to have been born with that other people didn't seem to have. And so I just ran wild, and I don't remember my first drink, as I mentioned, but in elementary school, I was a really good student. I was student body president. I got straight A's, and by seventh grade, I was dropping out of school. I was arrested when I was 11 for drinking in public. I lost my virginity at 12 to a really creepy older guy. He was 19, but I just couldn't bear the thought of him not liking me, and that's why I did that. And by 13, I was pregnant, and I ended up terminating that pregnancy at the urging of my mom and my boyfriend at that time. My boyfriend was 17, and I was 12. I was with him from the time I was 12 into my 20s, and then again in sobriety for a brief period of time. But he was, because he was so much older, he could have been in a lot of trouble. So when we were very poor, as I mentioned, my mom had to work three jobs. So to take care of that pregnancy, which I didn't want to do, but I did because my mom was so heartbroken, I had to say that I didn't know who the father was. And that was just kind of the beginning of a whole series of things that were just breaking my spirit. And I made a whole lot of choices that I thought would make you love me that only made myself hate myself more. So I was doing these things so you could love me, because if you loved me, then I would be okay. But as I did them, I hated myself more and more and more, and I hated myself and somehow thought that if you loved me, I would somehow love myself. And that does not happen. I did not learn until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous that emptiness that I felt inside, that the only way that that gets filled is by giving. It's not by getting. Getting is good, but it never fills that emptiness I feel inside. It's always by being of service. It's when I'm lonely, I have to reach out. I have to make the call. I have to be of service, and that's what fills that emptiness. But back then, I was filling it with whatever I could. And you know, I always use this example because I haven't thought of a better one, but you know, even today, almost 22 years sober, I watch reruns of Sex and the City. It's my favorite show. And they drink these fabulous drinks out of these beautiful glasses. And, you know, they're out at a fabulous club. And I've never had those flavored drinks. I've never had a Cosmopolitan or a flavored martini or any of those kind of drinks. I was more like a 10 high and a pack of Marlboro Red Box girl. And so I watch this and I think, oh, that would be lovely. I should do that. I could do that. And I think how lovely it would be to drink out of those beautiful glasses and laugh and talk about Mr. Big and how lovely that would be. And then I remember that the way I drink is with a funnel and a hose, you know, like like this. Never happened, ever. I always drank like a pig. I started... Really, I should probably like find some kind of story like Animal House or something, you know, like, that's more like my drinking than, you know, when I'm fantasizing to remember that. But I started to learn, you know, how to get drunk quicker, especially at that age, because it's hard to get alcohol. So I was stealing booze, and then I was learning about beer bonging, which is what I was referring to with the funnel and the hose. And, you know, I could drink five beers in one gulp, and that gets you there. It takes a lot of, I've never said this from a podium, but I'm going to say it. It takes a lot of projectile vomiting to really master that. Good for me, not so much for my friends that I was with, but... Yeah, so I always drank like a pig, and I identify as an alcoholic, and I believe my alcoholism gets me wherever I'm weak, and that can be food, sex, money, drugs, whatever. And so I said yes to a whole lot of things, and I started starving when I was 13, and I started throwing up when I was 17 in order to look perfect, to be perfect, so you would love me, and then I would be okay. And I did not get any recovery from any of these outside issues until I addressed my alcoholism. And by addressing my alcoholism, all those things seem to resolve. And, you know, I have to work a diligent program in AA today because my alcoholism's always looking for a way out. It can be all of those things still are looking for a way, you know, like all the snacks that are in that hospitality room. It's like, would you like a cookie? A cookie? No, I want 10. You know, it's like, more. And, oh, that guy's cute. I want to have sex with him. You know, it's like constant. So I have to work a really diligent program so there's no breach in security. But my alcoholism's, you know, like a want monster. It's wants all the time. And so, yeah. Anyway, so I did not know that I would be speaking at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my friend Doug always says, had I known, I would have said no to that joint. But I said yes to everything, and I went through a lot of different phases with drugs. And when it would get out of control, I could always stop because I had alcohol. And as I said, by 13 I was pregnant, terminated that pregnancy, and drank and used over that for a long time, and somehow made it through school by going to summer school and making up credits. And always when my life was falling apart, I could somehow pull it back together quickly and get back on track. But after you do that so many times, you start to get tired. And I started suicide attempts when I was 12. As I said, I hated myself desperately. In elementary school, the kids called me BFU, which stood for Big, Fat, and Ugly. And then in junior high, the kids came up with another nickname for me based on the size of my lips, which I will not repeat today. But people pay to have their lips done now, so... But I used to try and pretend like I didn't have any until, you know, I got drunk and I couldn't hold it in. But I wouldn't wear lipstick. I would always kind of do this, and it was just weird. But for somebody like me where your approval okays my existence, it was devastating. And I hated myself, and our house was weird, and my mom was angry, and she worked all the time, and our house was that house in the neighborhood with the overgrown yard, and... my mom would yell at my friends when they'd come over. My mom felt like I was going to party. So I may as well do it at home. It's better that I do it at home. So I could have all my friends over. Sometimes she'd buy kegs for parties. Sometimes she'd buy me booze. But she'd rather that I do it at home. And so friends would knock on the door and she'd say, "Who's that scratching at the door?" And I, you know, one of my friends would be like, "Is Georgia home?" And she'd say, "She's in the opium den," which is what she called my room. And we had a house full of cats. And so they would be being cats, and my mom would be yelling at them. And so I'd hear her yell, "Get down!" And I would be so embarrassed until finally we kind of turned it into a game. So we'd be partying in my room, and we'd hear my mom yell, "Get down!" Which meant everybody had to get up. No matter what you were doing, you had to stop and get down. So, yeah. But so I was so embarrassed. And so at 12, I tried to kill myself. I tried to kill myself again at 13. And then my last suicide attempt, I was in my 20s. And I had a pattern of going man to man to man, or actually... there was a lot of overlapping, so it was men. It wasn't man to man. It was men. So lots of overlapping, because nobody could ever love me enough to fill that emptiness, and I blame. blamed you. I blamed the guy. You know, you can't love me enough. If you did, you would. And then, you know, fill in the blank. I could come up with 1,000 things you do if you really loved me. So then I'd have to find somebody else who would love me. And so that was kind of the pattern of my life at that time. And I was in the middle of an overlap and took a bottle of pain medication my roommate had and drank some vodka to wash it down. And then I was sitting there and my world had become really small by then. I was in my early 20s and I'd, you know, alienated every friend. I'd had great jobs that I'd lost and, you know, my world was just really, really small. And I realized nobody was going to find me. And I thought, oh dear, maybe I've gone too far. And so I called at the suicide hotline. True story, there was no answer. And so I called information, or I can't remember if I called information or found it in the phone book, but I found some suicide prevention line. And I called that and I said, this is what I drank, this is what I took. If I make myself sick, will I be okay? And he said, no, you need to call 911. And I'm like, oh. So I call 911. I'm like, hey, so I took this and I drank this, but it's no big deal. I mean, listen to me, I'm fine. If I make myself sick, will I be okay? No, we need to send an ambulance. Ugh, you know, how embarrassing. So I said, well, you don't need the sirens and all that. Everything's cool. The next thing I hear is like sirens, woo, woo, you know, and running down the hall. And the paramedics come in, and they are totally hot. Which is such a weird thing. It's like my alcoholism is this want monster with an inferiority complex. So sometimes I feel like I'm a piece of crap, and then other times I'm thinking, aren't you lucky to be coming to my house? And such a weird thing. So the paramedics come in, and I'm like, hey, how you doing? And they get me on the stretcher, and they take me to the hospital where I have my stomach pumped. And when you have your stomach pumped, they then fill you with charcoal. And so then you have the big charcoal frown. So I've got I'm working the charcoal frown. And I talked the therapist there. They're supposed to put me on a 72-hour hold, but we're very manipulating. And I talked him into letting me go that night. And went home and then realized that paramedic station was right across the street from where I lived and thought I'd pay him a visit. So it was the next day, and I sauntered over after I fixed my hair like Farrah, which is how I like to do my hair back then. Farrah Fawcett, for those. It was a hairstyle. So I walk over there, and I'm like, hey, how you doing? Remember me? You took me to the hospital last night. I tried to kill myself. How are you? So embarrassing. So embarrassing. And they were so nice to me, and they, you know, scooted me along because they were used to dealing with crazy people. So, oh, it's so humiliating, though. It's so horrible, all those, just how much I hated myself and how I kept doing these things. It was just a series of just horrible, horrible reality TV. And at that time, my roommate had a brother who had been kicked out by his wife because he had a little problem with crack cocaine. But he was better now. But he needed a place to live because he just got better. And and so he came to live with us. Guess what? He wasn't better. But the thing I loved most about him is that he was crazy about me. And it really didn't matter how I felt about him at all. It was just that he was crazy about me, and I so desperately needed that. And I don't know about you, though. I don't like being with somebody who has a different buzz. And it was weird. And he would sneak away, and then he'd come back, and he'd be all up. Like, ew, it was just gross. And so I said, I want to do that. And not an option to leave. Just how do I accept being with somebody? It's like in the 80s when you'd go to a party, and, you know, it's like a kegger party, and then a few people slip off to the bathroom. And then all of a sudden they come back and they're like, hey, how's it going? And you're like, ooh. But then they call you off into the bathroom, and then you come out and you're like, hey, how's everybody doing? Where's the keg? So it's kind of like that. So as soon as I did it with him, it didn't seem so creepy. And But within 6 months, because that was something I could not just simply stop and go back to alcohol, that annihilated my life. I lost everything within 6 months. I got fired from my job, evicted from where I lived, and he sold my car for a piece of crack cocaine at that time, about that big, and it went for about $20. And I had nowhere to go. My mom had moved away when I was 17. I'd been on my own since then. She moved up north to be with her mother, and the two of them were in their reclining chairs talking about the world and how they got screwed. And I had nowhere to go, and my best friend Diana and I grew up together in La Crescenta, and which is, by the way, where I live again today. We grew up partying together, but she grew out of it, moved to San Diego, was going to college. She was having a normal life. And her parents still lived in La Crescenta, and she said, you can go live with my parents. And so I went to live with them. They had a room in their basement. And I didn't know what to do. I couldn't stop drinking. There was no way I was going to stop drinking, especially at that point. I mean, things were bad. I needed a drink. And I'd been to AA with a couple of my friends who really needed it. Poor dears. And AA, they have to go. And I just knew that that wasn't for me, and so I drank and counted the days when I didn't drink and tried to stay sober and, you know, the marks on the calendar and starting over, and it just became exhausting. And I poured my first guilt-free drink. I decided I'd rather be drunk and miserable than sober and miserable. Poured my first guilt-free drink, White Zin in the box, and was enjoying that, and the phone rang, and it was a guy who worked with my friend Diana, and she said, I understand you have a problem with alcohol. And I said, I do. And he said, I want to give you the number of a woman to call in AA. And he gave me the number of Pat Y. And I called her, and she said, my husband and I, Vince Y, who some of you know, we're going to a meeting tonight. Why don't you come with us? And so I drove to their house, and it still gives me goosebumps every time I share that a stranger called me, gave me the number of another stranger who took me to a room full of strangers, and I've been sober ever since. I mean, how does that happen? That's AA. Yeah, I do not take my sobriety lightly. It is the greatest gift of my life, you know, and that's one of the reasons I get so nervous, too, when I talk is I want to convey to you what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for my life. It didn't give me back a life. It gave me a life, you know, and I don't know how things could line up for me ever again like that, you know, so I know this is a gift, and it is my priority. So I went to this meeting with Pat and Vince, and I had a moment of hope, and I had not had that in a long time. There was a room full of people kind of like this. There's about 1,000 people who attend, and the light was on in people's eyes, and they were laughing. They seemed to be happy and sober at the same time. And this was perplexing to me. And I wanted to see what that was about. And I remember at the end, we got up and said the Lord's Prayer, and I was not raised with any kind of God, and so the Lord's Prayer, you know, I didn't even know it, and I felt so ashamed about that. But I felt hope, and Pat said, I'll be your sponsor until you find one. And I said, okay. And she gave me some meetings to go to, regular meetings on regular days, and just told me to get commitments at those meetings and call her every day. And I did that. And at first I thought, well, I'll just do this for 30 days, maybe 60, maybe 90, whatever. I kept changing it. And then I kept hearing about this first year foundation, get your first year foundation. And then I thought, okay, well, I'll try this for a year. And then when it doesn't work, I can go back to my glamorous life. And luckily I haven't had to do that. But I did everything that I was asked to do, almost with that in mind, like, okay, I'll do that. And when it doesn't work, I get to go back to my wonderful life, like somehow somebody was holding me prisoner there. And Pat was a lot longer sober than I was, and it just seemed, she seemed beyond what, I just couldn't even imagine staying sober that long. So when she said, I'll be your sponsor until you find one, I found somebody with closer sobriety than me, somebody who was doing all the stuff, who was like 7 years sober at the time, and I just did everything she did, and she got me going on the steps. And I don't know about you, but when I got sober, and kind of when I do everything, I'm like this, you know, now that I'm sober, I'm going to go on a diet, I'm going to eat healthy, I'm going to quit smoking, I'm going to get a great job. Oh, I should go to school. I hear a lot about that. And it's time for a relationship. And luckily, I shared all that with my sponsor. And she said, why don't you take all the time and energy you'd put into a relationship, put that into going to your meetings and committing to your group, and all the time and energy you'd want to put into going into school, why don't you put that into getting your steps done? And for God's sake, don't quit smoking. No major changes in the first year. And no relationship, which I've been in a relationship since I was 10. I don't even know what she's talking about. And but I wanted what you guys had, and I saw that you had something. And I didn't understand what it was or how you got it, but it kept me interested long enough to be willing. I was willing. And so I started, you know, doing these simple things. And at about 2 weeks sober, I have to go back just a little bit, a family friend came forward and told me a bunch of secrets that my mom had kept from me. And normally what I would have done with such information is I would have gone to my mom and told her what I thought about her, because I thought that that was integrity and was to be honest and tell people what you really think about them. And so I had a very wicked tongue. But I did something different here, and what I did is I took those secrets that family friend had told me and took them to my sponsor, and I said, this is what I found out. And Pat was my sponsor still at 2 weeks, and she said, it's so good that you have those written down, because I wrote them in a journal and then read them to her. She said, you're going to need those later. And I had no idea what she was talking about. She said, but for right now, I want you to work on being a good daughter and granddaughter, which I had no idea what that meant, because I didn't really have that example, and I didn't know how do you do that. And so we came up with a formula, because I take things really literally, and that was that I would call once a week, I'd write once a week, and I'd visit as often as I could. If I did those things, I would know at the end of the day when my head hit the pillow that I'd been a good daughter and granddaughter, and if I knew that, then I could stay sober. Because where my mom and grandma were related was such a source of pain for me. I loved them. I felt loyal to them. I hated them. I blamed them. I was embarrassed of them. And they were all I had in the world. And so every time something with them came up, it was like, you know, it was just so much pain. And I knew, or my sponsor knew, I couldn't stay sober like that. And so I started taking these actions, and at first I would just get a card. Oh, and let me say that I did not tell my mom and grandma that I was going to do this. I didn't say, guess what, I'm going to send you a card every week and call once a week. Isn't that great? Because every time I would tell people what I would do, I wouldn't do it, and I knew that. And so I started to learn about letting my actions speak louder than my words. And, well, they always have. I just got that. So I started sending the cards, and at first I would just write, love, Georgia, and then I would call once a week kind of with a topic like, I see the weather in your area is pretty good. That's great. You know, or whatever. I would have to have something, because it was so awkward when I would call, because before I would only call in the midst of horrible things like, I have no place to live, I have no money, I don't know what I'm going to do, call soon, you know, and then I wouldn't call for months. So every time I would call, they would say, oh my God, we thought you were dead. No, I'm not dead. So it was really hard to get that started, and there's so much to be said about consistency. So I start calling once a week, and I send a card that same day, so they're getting a contact from me twice a week. Sending the card, writing just a very little bit, and then eventually I started picking up the pace and writing about my adventures in sobriety, which I kind of felt guilty about, because my mom and grandma's life, I didn't know much about it, but I knew that it was not good, and they were sitting in their reclining chair smoking cigarettes all day, watching TV, and they were unhappy. I knew that. And so for me to have this amazing life kind of growing, I felt a little bit guilty, but I started sharing it with them, and I started sharing about my adventures in sobriety. And then as I do, I became grandiose, and I thought perhaps they were saving these cards and rereading them from time to time, just tickled with my adventures. But what was really happening was not that. And I called on my weekly call, and I said, hi, Mom. And she said, well, we got your card. But Grandma's been having to wipe them out to reuse them. Can you start writing them in pencil? Yeah. So, and at that time I said yes, and I'll tell you why. Because I had a sponsor who had said I can bring all my problems to her and I would never have to do anything ever alone again. I was starting to have an experience of a higher power. I had this amazing fellowship, and I had all these tools that I never knew existed. And my mom and grandma had none of that. And although it's unfair, he with the most tools has the most responsibility, and I was that one. And so I started writing those damn cards in pencil, and for a while I wrote a little bit less to punish them. I don't think they noticed, though. It sucks when you punish someone with silence or something and they don't even notice, but whatever. And so I started writing a little bit less, and I picked up the pace again and writing those cards in pencil, calling once a week, getting really active in my group, going through the steps and what freedom there was in that. You know, I didn't have an experience of a higher power, but what our steps do is that's the purpose of our steps. You know, we do all these steps so we can do our 12th step, which is to carry the message. And the way that you tap into that joy that you see in a lot of old timers is you do those steps, and that's the gateway to freedom, you know. And so I was able to start doing those steps with Tracy, who was my sponsor then, and Marilyn's now. Marilyn Slater's been my sponsor for the last 19 years, and I finished them with her. But what freedom there was in that, and I just didn't think that all the secrets I was carrying carried so much weight until I shared them with someone else, and what freedom there was, and getting through those amends steps. And I had to make amends to, you know, financial amends, living amends. I had to show up for a warrant. You know, I had all sorts of stuff. But what freedom there was in all of that. And my life was getting really good, and I made it to my first year. And in our group, we have something called a watch when you turn one, and that's the night before you turn one. Everybody gets together after the meeting at a coffee shop, and we hang out, and at midnight everybody counts down to midnight and sings happy birthday for you. It's really exciting. It's like 10, 9, and you're like ah, and at one everybody sings and you blow out a candle, and then everybody who's come to your watch comes by your table and you shake their hand. And within a year, I knew everyone at my watch except for one person. And there were so many people there, and I couldn't believe how much my life had changed in just a year. And as I mentioned, I was given direction not to be in a relationship for my first year, and I take things very literally. So at about 1:30 a.m., oh yeah, I consummated a relationship with a fella who proposed to me 10 days later. So yeah, we waited, and we got married about 6 months later, and I was married to Mark for my first 5 years of sobriety, and we had a really good life because we always put AA first. We always, that always had to come first, but our marriage did not work out, and because we did put AA first, because we worked with our sponsors, we are friends today, still in the same home group, which is amazing, because I don't end relationships well. P.S., I don't do them well either. So, today much better than then. But so I went through all of that, and, you know, it was hard going through that. Now I've been married and divorced twice in my home group. I've been in the same home group since I was 24, which means I did a lot of growing up and a lot of, yeah, a lot of stuff. A lot of things I've done have been in my sobriety in front of God and everyone. And luckily I have a sponsor who says you can't change your meetings when you're uncomfortable. You have to go to the meeting. So instead of going to the meeting and going, hey, how you doing? You look good. Is everything okay? Instead of doing that, I learned to say, it's good to see you. Have a good meeting. I mean, it's such a simple thing, right? But it changed everything. I got to walk through everything I've done with some sort of grace and dignity, because I've always worked with a sponsor, you know, and our sponsors can see our whole picture. Like, here I am in my picture, and I can see, you know, there's Joyce. Hey, what's up? And, you know, I can look over here, and there's Lee and Hillary, who sings so pretty. But I can't see what's right here, you know, and my sponsor can see that. No matter how long I'm sober, I always need a sponsor who can see my whole picture. Just like when I sponsor someone, I can see their whole picture. And so I'm so grateful that I've been in a group that has a really strong sponsorship ethic. So Mark and I were married for 5 years, and when we got divorced, I got involved with someone right away. Surprise. And bet you didn't see that coming. And I thought that this guy was the one, because even though I wouldn't have admitted at the time, I was still desperately looking for someone to complete me. And if you are looking for someone to complete you, your relationship will fail. This is my experience anyway. That I need to be complete when I come into a relationship, and I need to be with someone who enhances my life and vice versa. If I'm looking for someone to complete me, that means that I'm incomplete without them. And that means my reliance is on them and not on my higher power. And my reliance has to be on my higher power. I can't keep myself happy, at least up until this point. And now I'm putting that responsibility on someone else and then punishing them for not being able to do it. It's kind of twisted, but it's taken a long time of practicing these principles in all my affairs. And so I got involved with someone right away, and I had back issues, and I had a minor back surgery early in sobriety, and I had to have a more major surgery. I had a spinal fusion, and they went through the front. And I was in that 1% or whatever that there's complications, and I ended up being bedridden for about a year. Yeah, it was heavy. Because I had found my happiness in being of service and being really busy, morning to night, go to work, go to a meeting. I was taking classes, I was giving people rides, I was sponsoring people, I was doing everything you could do from morning till night, very, very little sleep. And all of a sudden, my whole life came to a halt, and I had to learn to be of service in a different way, which was letting people help me, which is really, really hard. And I look back now at these really seemingly difficult times in my life, and I see how they were some of the best times. They were the times where I connected with people at a real level that's just not available when your life's like, woo-hoo! You know, I had people coming over to take care of me because I'd have babysitters every day, coming over to take care of me that I wouldn't have had coffee with, you know. And just like when you meet people on a commitment and you think, oh, I can't believe I got a commitment with old whatever. And then you grow to love these people, you know, and that I'm so grateful that I have, I've had such good care in my home group. And my mom and grandma weren't able to be there for me. They were kind of, I guess, agoraphobic, except my grandma could fly to Montana every year, but she couldn't come to L.A. Whatever, I've worked it out. Oh. So I was losing everything. I had the surgery. There were complications. I couldn't keep my apartment. I couldn't keep my car. I couldn't color my hair. And my boyfriend came to me and he said he'd consider a relationship and a commitment with me when I was well. And he dumped me. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, because I always forget to say this, we are friends today too. And we're in the same home group. We're good friends. Not at that time. I was brokenhearted, and I called Marilyn, who I mentioned has been my sponsor for a long time, and I called her and I told her the latest installation of my pain. You know, it was all these steps of losing things. You know, I have to have surgery, complications, lost my job, lost my car, now the man. And she was learning to play guitar at the time, and so she said, oh, this sounds like a wonderful country western song. And she played a country chord progression and sang my blues. And it made me laugh, you know, and I've learned that that's really what's carried me through, is having a sense of humor about everything. And some of my saddest moments have been some of Marilyn's funniest. That doesn't seem right. But she is wonderful. I forgot to mention, like, I was about 3 years sober, and I was still sending the cards and visiting when I could and making the weekly call, and I was having this completely different relationship with my mom and grandma, all because of what I was doing on my side of the street. What they do on their side of the street, none of my business. The dirtier your side of the street is, the cleaner mine needs to be. My work on my spiritual condition every day is all about my side of the street. That's the only place I can access power. And so just by doing these things on my side of the street, my relationship with them was changing. And I do have to mention that my mom and grandma also did not believe that they should ever have to call me. So they would say, well, we wanted to wish you a happy birthday, but you didn't call. So I learned that I could get up on my birthday and say, I know they're not going to call. I know they're not going to call. And then at the end of the day say, I knew it. Or I could wake up on my birthday and say, hey, it's my birthday. I just want to tell you I love you. And then enjoy the rest of my day. Magic. But at about 3 years sober, I sent a card and I accidentally wrote it in pen. And they mentioned it. My mom said, "We got your card." It was in pen. And I was not feeling so spiritual. I was spiritual enough to say, "Ooh, look at the time, I've got to run." And called my sponsor, Marilyn, and I said, "I'm done. I write, I call, I visit, I'm done." And Marilyn said, "Oh, I think you've made a wonderful amends to your mother and grandmother, and you don't owe them anything else." And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "However, I think it would be a wonderful spiritual exercise if you continued to do so." And that's how Marilyn gives me direction. I'll say, "Well, I've got option A or option B." And she'll say, "Well, you could do option A. Or you could fight for the good. It's up to you." Is it really? It's not really up to me. But so now flash forward, I'm going through all these health issues. My home group's taking care of me. The guy just dumped me. And I'm devastated. And for me, I can pray for a character defect to be removed, but what normally happens is an assignment appears. Like with my mom and grandma, I had the sense of entitlement and all these demands, and instead I was taught to be loving and kind and tolerant, and I practiced that. And so now I'm useless, is how I feel. I'm useless, I'm full of self-pity. I was diagnosed with something called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, which is a disease of your sympathetic nervous system, and it can happen from a trauma or injury, and they think it happened from my surgery, and I'm looking at stuff on the internet. Ooh, don't do that. And this is a disease that's been around since the Civil War. I didn't know anything about it, though, but in the past what they would do is sometimes they'd do amputations, sometimes you'd end up paralyzed, but the doctor that I was seeing had a patient right before me that he wasn't able to diagnose for about a year. And the key in this is to get it quickly. So when I came through with this, and it wasn't a blood clot, which is what they thought it was, he knew exactly what was wrong with me and started treatment right away. So I was going to the hospital 3 times a week, getting injections, lumbar and cervical punctures, where they were going in my neck and my spine. And I would do that 3 times a week, and it was my AA group that was taking me to and from the hospital, bringing meetings to me, taking me to meetings. I'd bring a lounge chair, and I'd lay in the back of my meetings. And so grateful for that. But I was so full of self-pity, and there was a guy in our group named Mike Finch, and he had Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS. And I had seen him. He used to come from Las Vegas to L.A., then he moved to San Diego, and he'd come up to L.A. every Wednesday night for the meeting. And he'd bring a group of guys he sponsored, and I went from seeing him walking and talking to being in a wheelchair, paralyzed from the neck down. And the thing that never changed about him was his joy about Alcoholics Anonymous, his joy for life. He sponsored tons of guys. He loved this program, and he was amazing, and he was such an inspiration to me. And so he and I became friends, and then we became more than friends, and I was able to spend the last 6 months of his life with him. I'm so grateful for that. It was such a wonderful, scary, terrifying, horrible, beautiful, fun, horrific, wonderful experience, all wrapped up. And I got to be there for every bit of it. I got to feel every bit of the joy and sadness. And I'm so grateful for that. And he was such a wonderful example and so full of just love of this program. I used to call him the Make-A-Wish boy. Which actually is kind of offensive, but he had a really good sense of humor. But, you know, he knew he was dying in a very short period of time, and so he lived his life that way. I think, I mean, to a certain degree, we should all do that anyway, but it was AA who was taking care of him, too, and we all kind of took care of each other, and I'd wake up. I ended up moving to San Diego to be with him, and we'd wake up in the morning, and I'd walk out in the living room, and there'd be bodies all over the place because people had come in the night before to see him and to say goodbye, and people were coming in from all over, and we'd go to meetings, and we'd have meetings, and we laughed, and we had the greatest time. I mean, it was a beautiful time, and the thing that happened in me falling in love with Mike was that I saw something about myself that was redeemable. And I did not know that I was capable of loving somebody like that. Mike was not even able to hug me back. You know, I would hug him, and sometimes tears would just run down his face because he couldn't hug me back, but it didn't matter because I knew he loved me, and we had something that was bigger than that. And I just did not know that I was a person who was capable of that, and that was a result of, you know, being a part of this program. And we had so much fun, and I was able to be there when he died. About a month before he died, my grandma passed away, and I was able to be there for my mom emotionally. I wasn't able to be there physically because I still didn't have a car, and I was still having a lot of physical issues. And a friend of mine took me up there at one point. And then about a month later, Mike died, and his dad was holding one of his hands, and I was holding the other. And what a great privilege to be there as someone, you know, goes on. And his parents always, over the last, okay, so that was 15 years ago, over the last 15 years have always just treated me like I was part of the family, and they wanted to put something for me on his tombstone. They called me his companion. And he was married. His wife had left him, and my boyfriend had left me, so he was still married when he died. And so they wanted to honor me in that way, and it almost seemed like they were loving, they were giving me too much credit for just having spent 6 months of Mike's life with him, and I never got it, but I accepted it, and I loved them. And Mike's dad walked me down the aisle the last time I got married, and you know, so it's been a wonderful thing. But a couple of years ago on Facebook, on the anniversary of Mike's death, which is November 17th, we were posting things, and Susanna, his mom, posted this story that I never knew, and it was this. Mike was 34 when he was 30 when he was diagnosed, and the way that you die of Lou Gehrig's is your muscles stop working, and essentially your lungs are a muscle. So the way that you die is you suffocate. It's really gruesome. And so Mike, and they can keep you alive longer by doing all sorts of extraordinary measures. Well, he decided he didn't want that. When it got to the point where he was getting like that, they would put him into a drug-induced coma and he would go. And they really didn't want him to do that. They wanted him to get the feeding tube to try and live. But he had made the decision, and then he and I hooked up at this conference in Arrowhead called Mountain High. And he came back from that trip, and he called a family meeting, and he said, "I want the feeding tube." And because he'd fallen in love. And so that's why his family was always so grateful to me. I'm like, oh, I get it. You know, so they felt like he got these extra 6 months, and I never knew that. I mean, what a beautiful thing. So my grandma had died, and then Mike had died, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do with my life. I was still having health problems. I still have chronic pain today, but I treat it with Alcoholics Anonymous and Pilates, and I don't want to have any, like, debates about this afterwards. I've done a lot of things. This is just what I do. It works for me. So I ended up moving back to LA to try and start my life over again, I guess, and my mom asked to see me. And I drove up to Cambria where she lived, and we sat for 2 days, and she told me her story. And I never knew my mom's story. I knew bits and pieces, and I knew that there were a lot of secrets. I found out a few, you know, when I was newly sober. But she sat and basically did a fist step with me, not technically, but that's what it was like. And she said, "There's some things I need to tell you, and I couldn't tell you because your grandma was still here, and they involve her." And so my mom was honoring her mother by keeping these secrets. She and my grandma hadn't discussed these things even while they were living together all those years. They were even secrets that they couldn't talk about. And so she started telling me about how my grandma was put out of her house when she was 8 years old because the family couldn't keep both of the children, so they sent my grandma to live with another family, where at 8 years old my grandma became like the house girl and serviced the men in the family. And she never went to another day of school. And the way that she got out of that was she got pregnant at 18 with my mother. And my grandma had, like, no skills for being a parent, and had my mom in and out of boarding schools, and left her at boarding schools, would forget her for summers while my grandma had hooked up with some unsavory fellows who were involved in racketeering and prostitution. And my grandma led that lifestyle, and she became a madam, and at 15 she turned my mom out to do the same thing. And so my mom had a couple of pregnancies that she put up for babies she put up for adoption, which was why she was so adamant about what happened to me when I was 13, and I didn't know that, because of the pain that she had experienced on the other side, and she was trying to protect me. And she was physically abused, sexually abused, emotionally abused by every person she had ever loved, every person she had trusted. One of the pregnancies, my grandma thought that it was my grandma's boyfriend had impregnated her and so punished my mom and sent her to live out on the street as punishment. And she just had the most horrific life I'd ever heard. And I had no idea. I had no idea the things she'd endured. And the secrets that I'd found out were kind of minor, like that my mom and dad had never been married. My mom was actually my dad's mistress, and he left his wife for my mom, so there was always that going on, which explains why we weren't at his funeral. So it's like all these things started making sense, and I saw my mom in a different way, and I'm so grateful that I was taught here to treat her like she was this great mom, to send the cards, to make the calls, to do all of that, because as it turns out, my mom was like a superhero. What she was able to do with me was better than the life my grandma had had, better than the life that she had. She kept me in the same house for 17 years. I never really wanted for anything, and the love and direction that I wanted for, that I felt that she withheld from me, was something she never possessed. And I spent years being mad at her for giving me something she never herself possessed. It wasn't that she was withholding it from me. She just never had it to give. And so I was so grateful that I'd been taking these actions up until this point to be a good daughter, and that the door was opened by the consistency, that she was able to share these things with me. And then I started having a mad crush on my mom. Like, I was just like, wow, she's the coolest lady ever. I can't believe it. And I can't believe she survived all this. And I had long since learned to take my mommy stuff to my sponsor and to my friends. And so I just got to get to know Betty, and I used to call her Boop. And Boop was so smart, and although she didn't finish school either, she would work crossword puzzles like crazy. She knew every answer on Jeopardy. Crazy. I could call her about stuff about cooking, about history. She knew it all. Although now that I've heard Adrian's talk, she may have been making some of that up. But I believed her anyway. And she was really, really funny. And I got to get to know her. And what a blessing that was. You know, well-meaning psychologists had talked to me about confronting and not keeping, you know, setting boundaries and not keeping secrets and all of these sort of aggressive things. And instead, I was taught just to treat my mom with love and tolerance and compassion and worry about my side of the street. And as a result, I got to know this magnificent woman who was so damaged. And she, the thing that she turned to for comfort was hoarding. And she was, I couldn't even walk through her house. I had to walk sideways. I couldn't stay at her house when I would go to see her. And it was just something I grew to accept with the help of my sponsor. I got to love my mom exactly where she was. And I'm looking at the time. Okay. She ended up being diagnosed with cancer and was treated for that, and it came back a couple years later, and it was in her lungs, and then it went to her bones, and then it went to her brain. And I had this experience taking care of Mike, so now I could go take care of my mom using that experience. And I went and I spent the last few months of her life with her. And again, all these doors were open because of the intimacy I was building, we were building with the phone calls and the cards and all of those things opened the door for this really intimate time of taking care of somebody as they die. And she was 75 years old. She was so, so sick. And we went to the hospital, and an x-ray technician came out for some test. And she looked at him right in the eye, and she said, "This won't affect my ability to bear children, will it?" I know. And it was so wonderful. It just made me laugh. And I'm so, so grateful. I keep saying that, but it's true, that I got to get to know her. And I was devastated when she died. During that time, I gave her the best I had, but I didn't give her the best that there was because I wasn't taking care of my spiritual condition. I was running on empty. My mom didn't have any friends. We didn't have any family. She was my only family. And so I was doing everything by myself, and I wasn't going to meetings, and I was still in touch with my sponsor and doing all of that, but it was just every day was about taking care of her, and I was depleted. And I find, you know, our book says we won't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. But for me, what happens is I do feel regret about things until I'm able to take whatever that experience is and share it with someone else to help them, or use that experience to change something that's going on now. And so I suffered a long time with regret about that I didn't give her the best there was. I gave her the best I had, but not the best there was. And, you know, I'd been such a good daughter up until that point. When I came back from that experience, I was in a marriage with a guy that I shouldn't have been on a second date with. No offense to him. He's a very lovely person. I just was in no place to be. I was looking for somebody to complete me and then punished him for not being able to do it. And I was so miserable, and I wasn't working, and I didn't know what to do with my life. And I got to the point where I just felt like killing myself. And so I decided that that's what I needed to do. And suddenly this voice, very much like the voice that came into my head before I got to AA, that said, you need to get sober. This voice said, go through the steps again. And I did that. I went through the steps again. And this inventory with double-digit sobriety, with my head firmly implanted in my rear, was the most boring inventory I've ever written. You know, my first one was sexy, and there were lots of naughty things I'd never told anyone, and it was all like, yeah. This one was like, and Julie hurt my feelings when she didn't invite me, and, you know, it was like so petty and just pages and pages of this stuff. But it was the stuff that was killing me, and I don't know how Marilyn stayed awake, honestly, as I read this. But that's the stuff that kills us. The big stuff, like, I've got a broken back. Everyone goes, oh, yeah, But when you have a broken heart, how do you talk about that, you know? And so I went through the steps again. I increased my meeting schedule, and just like it always does, it works. And what happened for me is with double-digit sobriety, I thought, I couldn't tell you how bad I was feeling, because on the outside, my life looked really good. And I somehow felt like I was failing AA. And again, back to what I was saying at the beginning, it's by sharing those things that gets rid of the separateness. And so, you know, today I know as long as I do those things, I can tap into, you know, amazing joy. And that's what happened for me. I didn't know what to do with my life. I'm going to tell you this last story and then I'll sit down. I was at a point where I didn't know if I wanted to be a grocery checker or a brain surgeon. Like, I didn't want to do anything. Nothing sounded good. And Marilyn always says, you know, just say yes to the universe. And and so I knew I needed to be busy. And I had started volunteering at the Midnight Mission when I was brand new. And I'd go down there for holidays and stuff. And I always felt the pull to be there. So I thought, well, I'll go volunteer there a few days a week while I'm looking for work. And in the meantime, I'll say yes to these things I'm asked to do. So well-meaning people are suggesting little jobs for me. Like, hey, they're doing the census. Why don't you get a job there? I hear they're paying more than minimum wage. Oh, that sounds great. Don't you know who I am? But I said, okay. So I went and I walked the beat and did the census and used this little computer that I had to learn how to use and ask people completely invasive questions about their life as I'm pounding at their door. And then there was a woman in the group who was dying of cancer, and I had been asking her husband, is there anything I can do? And one day he said, yeah, I really need help. I've got like 100 people. I need to schedule to stay with her while I'm at work and people to bring us dinner and get her to her doctor's appointments. Can you create a website to coordinate all this stuff? And I'm like, okay. I can barely turn on a phone, you know. I'm like, new. But I learned how to create this website and to coordinate all these schedules, and I did that. And then I had a friend who worked for an infomercial company, and she was selling all this stuff on eBay, and she needed somebody to go into 3,500 accounts and write, great transaction, thanks. So I did that all day for $20 an hour. Great transaction, thanks. And then enter the next account. I mean, seriously. So how could my life get worse? Well, I'm going to tell you. So part of my third step practice is that when I'm asked to do something, if my calendar's open, I say yes. That's AA or not, whatever. If my calendar's open, I kind of feel like that's where God wants me to be. It's a way of letting God keep my calendar. So I had to figure out a way. How do you do God's will? I don't know. So I say yes. So one of my old bosses that I worked for, who is a big producer, has a little band that he plays with some of his friends, and they were playing at the Roxy, and so I got an invite, hey, come hear my band at the Roxy, and I'm thinking, oh my God, please let my calendar be full, please, and it was open. I'm like, ah. So I show up at the Roxy, and actually, they were really good. You know, I want to do nothing ever. So the fact that I put stuff in a calendar and show up for it has given me a life, because really all I want to do is lay in bed and watch reruns of Law and Order. Honestly, that's all I ever want to do. So I show up for the thing, talk to him, great night, whatever. So flash forward, I'm volunteering at the Midnight Mission, and they say, we've got a position that we'd like you to interview for. And I'm like, oh my gosh, how amazing is this? And I'm thinking I'm going to start at the bottom. I'm going to be answering phones, probably filing, whatever. Well, it turns out they've created a position for me to work in the public affairs department, to help with events in the volunteer department. And so I go to this interview, and here are the questions. Do you have any experience learning new technology? And I say, yeah, I just worked for the census, and I had to learn to use these handheld computers. And they go, okay, well, we have a website, and we really need someone to manage that. Do you have any experience managing a website? And I'm like, well, I just created a website for this, you know, and I tell them the story. And then they're like, and sometimes we get donations, and we need to sell them on eBay. Do you have any experience with eBay? And I'm like, uh-huh. And then one of the job qualifications that's listed is must have a working knowledge of the 12 steps. And it was my 17th AA birthday, and I said, I've never said this in a job interview. I'm 17 years sober today. And so it seems like everything is perfect except for one little thing. Our human resources department needs to speak to somebody that you have directly reported to. I had all these references of people I worked with, but I wasn't in touch with any of my old bosses, except for the one who just played a gig at the Roxy. So I call him, but he's a producer. He works like 18 hours a day. There's no way you can reach him. But because I'd just seen him, I said, is there any way you can make this call for me? And he made it right away, and I ended up getting the job. And that's amazing. It's next to getting sober, it's the greatest thing that's ever happened in my life, working at the Midnight Mission, because I see people every day, like you or me, who have had all the yets happen to them, you know, and we serve our homeless community, and in Los Angeles, there's about 58,000 people who are homeless, and a large majority of those people are like you and me. They have drug and alcohol problems, and so I get to take all the love and hope that I find in these rooms, and I get to take them to Skid Row every day, and what a blessing that is, by doing a whole bunch of crap I didn't want to do. And that's sort of like, you know, we seek God's will, and the way that I do that is by practicing these principles, by working on my spiritual condition every day. And by doing that, you know, and going through these steps, I'm available. What does God need me to do? 10, 11, and 12 makes me available. What is the next assignment? And it's not always what I want it to be or think it should be. And, you know, I have a really good life today. As I said, Marilyn's my sponsor, and I love and adore her. I've watched her walk through things that I just didn't even think was possible. A couple of years ago, her son took his life suddenly. And well, at State Line, at Bob's retreat there, and a lot of you were there, and I watched her come back and walk through something that I didn't even know how she was going to survive. And she put AA first, and she showed up for all her commitments. And you know, I have this love of music. I dream that I would sing like Hillary, but not so much. And I find singing very cathartic, not so much for my audience, unfortunately. But I've had this opportunity, though, in sobriety to play music with a couple of people, and I've even had a chance to be a rock star in a band. Not really rock star, but we had a band and we played. Felt like a rock star. But something else that I've been able to do is I've been able to play music at weddings and funerals, and Marilyn asked me and my music partner to play at her son's funeral, which was such an honor. And to take this thing, like, I felt it was cruel that God had given me this love of music and this passion for music and made me suck at it. And I thought, how is this fair? And but I've been able to take all of those loves and passions that I have. That's how I can make myself most useful, is how do I take those passions that I believe God gave me and use that to help other people. And so it's been in things like that. And I started a music program at the Midnight Mission. And, you know, it's like I just had to kind of reroute it. You know, it wasn't about, look at me, I'm a big star. It was like, how can I bring music to other people? And so I've learned to access those passions in different ways. And, you know, today I'm in a relationship, and it's probably the best relationship I've ever had because I was complete when I got into it. And that was the one thing I did differently. And I have a really good life today, and I sponsor people, and I'm active in AA, and I'm just really grateful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's really amazing.